Welcome to The Sober Effect, a show that looks at the positives of sobriety, the dangers of alcohol, and the many people who are affected by it. I'm Kate.
And I'm Steph. The ripple effect of alcohol is far-reaching, and those are the stories you'll hear on The Sober Effect.
So today, Steph, we're going to talk about childhood and youth and how the way that we are, the way we're brought up, the experiences we have affect the way that we approach or seek alcohol as a kind of form of escape, because both of us started drinking at 14. It must have something to do with what was going on in our lives, because it's such a common thread, isn't it, in the sober community, that age. And it's very young. I mean, our children are older than that now, and the thought of them sitting in a park necking cans of Super Tenants just gives me the heebie-jeebies, really.
I know. And not to toot our horn, Kate, but we don't have children doing that. And we do have children at that age. And we're both really close to our kids. So for the listeners that are going to be like, well, how do you know? My daughter tells me everything. And I know your kids are the same way.
Yeah.
And we have this like trust between us. I mean, just recently she's told me some things that she's done and I won't say them out loud to embarrass her. But I know she would tell me. And yeah. I don't know if it's because of my own experience and now that I'm sober that I'm kind of raising her differently or like kind of giving her the things that that version of me needed at that age.
Yeah.
But we can.
I think it is definitely, Steph, the way you talk about so openly about your childhood and the pressures you felt, you are raising a completely different child to that.
Right.
You're making sure that she never feels any of the things that made you feel uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the wonderful things about taking a childhood that did have problems. You know, I had a very strange relationship with my mother, and I've taken that as a way of, I don't want to do that with my kids. So you have to learn, you have to move on.
True. And I think I kind of educated her on alcohol in a way that I wasn't educated. You know, we weren't really told that it was a drug. We were told about drugs, but I don't ever remember alcohol being in the same category. And the scenario or the theme with alcohol was always, it was cool, it relaxed you, it made you more fun. Like that was what I knew growing up about alcohol. No one ever told me anything different. And nothing against my parents, but they didn't have drinking problems either, right? Like they... Yeah. It wasn't an issue. They drank, but it was never like how I drank as an adult. And so I think there's something to me reflecting on that now that I'm sober and kind of telling my daughter the things that I wish somebody would have maybe warned me about. I don't know if it would have changed how I perceived alcohol. I would hope that it would. But I feel like letting Adeline know, hey, drinking isn't going to make you cooler. It's not going to make you have more fun. It's actually going to make you sick at times. My daughter has this huge phobia about throwing up. I totally, I use that to my advantage. Because like, if she feels a tinge of like mouth watering, like she's going to throw up, she has a complete meltdown. I'm like, yeah, you'll never do good as a drinker, because.
That's like Yvonne on our first ever episode.
Yes.
She was like that. And she said it's really put her off drinking because the thought of being sick is so awful. It's much worse than the hangover. I wish I had that.
Yeah, it's like, it's changed the way I have conversations about alcohol, I think, with my child. And I know it has for you, too. And I think that that's a great part of it. Like a good thing that came out of it for me is learning.
Our parents didn't know either, did they? I mean,
no.
Our parents didn't know alcohol was bad for you. My parents did drink a lot and still, my dad still does. But it was just what people did. So I grew up in a house where there was alcohol everywhere and I couldn't wait to be a grown up. So for me, as soon as I was old enough to buy alcohol, I was in the shop buying it or I was sneaking it before that, you know, because it was like that was the goal. That was the end goal for everyone who as soon as you turn sort of 13, it's like, when are we going to be able to have a drink?
Mm-hmm.
Because it was what all the cool people did. But to be fair, to them, they had no idea about, I mean, it was like smoking. Everyone used to just smoke in our house with all these kids running around. You just don't see that anymore.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, things have changed. And today's interview, I just loved it. And I've listened back to it twice already because there's so many nuggets of information in there that I want to explore further. And we're talking to Hilary Phelps, who is just incredible. I think we both had a bit of a crush on her by the end of the
A little bit.
Interview, didn't we? and she balances public speaking, coaching, and being a parent. And she does it in such an insightful and kind of charismatic way. She's just wonderful. And she's also very open, which, given her circumstances, when you find out it took 15 years before she told people she was sober, and she actually did it on a podcast called The Payoff with Pete, which is about, it kind of bridges sports and addiction.
Right.
And she shared her experience openly on that for the first time, which is incredibly brave. Mm. I just think she's fantastic.
Yeah. And I think a lot of our listeners are gonna relate to her as well.
Well, just a little recap on Hillary. As mm-hmm. a child, she was the fastest swimmer in the country for her age group, which is something that must have required so much dedication and commitment. Yeah. You know, I know kids that swim and they are at the swimming pool before school for a couple of hours and then after school. And she was also the eldest child. So, as we know, often considered like the strong one, the one that others look up to. So yeah. We started the conversation by asking her if she thought her childhood and the various pressures and labels that people put on themselves and other people put on them when they are growing up affects the way we look for escape through drinking. So let's hear what she had to say.
That has to be one of the best questions I've ever been asked. And I love that you came in hot with that one. Because it's so funny. I'm looking back, I'm doing a lot of work around that now because I have a 6-year-old. I'm like big on inner child work and, you know, making sure he develops these really healthy habits and has self-love and all of this. And so now I'm looking back on my childhood and I'm like, what could have been different? And I think, you know, we only know what we know. And I think times are different now. You know, then it was kind of grit is really important. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Just keep going. Don't let people see you cry. Be tough. And so that was kind of how I moved through the world when I was little. When I was younger, as a straight A student, like you said, I was the fastest swimmer in the country at age 11 and 12. And so perfectionism was something that was really glaring in my childhood. And it was driven by me. You know, my parents were really supportive. I had goals of being this Olympic swimmer. I love knowledge and I still do. And so a lot of those things were, you know, self-defined. But, you know, at the time, my parents both worked. My dad was a police officer. My mom was a teacher. And so they were providing for 3 kids. And so we, you know, went to daycare and swimming and things like that. You know, I feel like I did a lot of like self-nurturing as a child. You know, I would kind of find ways to escape, which for me early on looked like reading. Like I loved to read and that, you know, kind of went to the knowledge thing. But as I got older, especially now, I look back and I realize like there were some needs that maybe weren't met. And not because my parents were amazing and I had a wonderful childhood and I had such a great upbringing, you know, but I'm now learning about these things called like micro neglects. I had a great home. They always provided everything I needed. But what I really wanted as a child was this really deep connection. And I had really hard time connecting with other people when I was a child. And I have no idea where that came from, but I always wanted to have a person, you know, or to have people that I really connected to. And I don't know that I ever knew how. And I don't know if it was a skill that I didn't develop or just kind of went inward to find that connection myself through reading or being competitive and pushing myself. But as I got older, not knowing how to connect looked like experimenting with drugs and alcohol in order to try to find that connection in some way. And for me, you know, I do believe it's genetic. And so I have that gene of addiction and substance use disorder in my family. And so once I started putting that in my body and I was like, oh, okay, well, look, I can fit in here, right? Because I just wanted to fit in. And I felt like an awkward child because like I dressed really uniquely and my parents allowed me to explore that. But when I got older, I realized that I wasn't like everybody else or I didn't feel like everybody else. And when I was in 6th grade, I'd switched schools a couple of times because of my swimming, and which allowed me to do double practices in 6th grade. From 5 to 7 in the morning and again from 3 to 5 at night. And so these girls, as girls are mean, right? And I used to wear these leggings with like a skirt over it and like bracelets and like the, you know, all of this stuff, the 80s like Madonna. Mm-hmm. And like I laced up these ballet shoes and these girls were like nice shoes. And in that moment, that was when someone else's voice was louder than mine in my own head. And I allowed that moving forward to kind of dictate how I operated in the world of worrying what other people were thinking of me versus using that inner voice to guide me.
Wow. Like I've had the chills listening to you. Like I'm in a really weird place right now. Everything you just said really resonated with me because it is all about finding who you are and especially my sobriety journey. And right now I'm in this phase of letting go of everything I don't like. And it's hard because now I'm like, now what do I do? because I've let other people dictate what I like for so long that I am so confused. Like, what's my next move? Because for once, like, I want to own that. And something that we all three have in common is the age that we all started drinking is 14, which I find very interesting because Kate and I have found a lot of women started drinking at that age. I don't know what it is. I feel like there's something profound. And I think for me, that's when the outside voices got louder than the inside voices.
I feel like I found my voice at 44. You know, I just turned 46 on Sunday. And I feel like for so long, it wasn't that I honored my own voice. It was that I didn't know who I was. So therefore, yeah. I was attracting people that didn't align with how I felt because I couldn't define how I felt. I didn't know. And you're right. Like the vulnerability is really hard because if you're vulnerable and somebody isn't in the same space as you or isn't ready to hear it or doesn't respect you or whatever that is, or they don't know themselves, you feel unsafe. We all want safety and love and companionship and those things. And I think it all starts with us, but we don't know. I don't feel like that's something that we're taught either. Mm-hmm. It's the paradigm, right? Like what we're taught in school by parents, by, you know, churches, institutions, mm-hmm. other people. They tell us how we should live. They tell us how to define ourselves. And I've been sharing this book called Women That Run With The Wolves with any woman that I talk to. And it's amazing because it talks about how women are just intuitive and we're these, like, we can be these wild beings, but we're told to put our feet on the floor, not sweat, don't talk like that. The women don't do things like that. And we're put in these boxes where really we're these beautiful, intuitive, wild beings that need to have expression and creativity. And we're told to like tamp it down.
And I think that starts from childhood. And as you say, we try and fit in. And I've got a 13-year-old daughter and I talk to her all the time because I'm just so aware of what goes on. And I see some of the messages in the groups and the chat, and it's almost like elbowing each other out of the way. You've got to conform. They're almost doing it to each other. And I don't understand it. And I keep saying to her, do not put a mask on at this age because it could be 20 years before you take it off.
They're so lucky to have you, a mom that's so confident in herself to allow them to express their self in that way, right? Because I think a lot of parents, and this is what I've been focused on, like the next evolution of being the best I can be, is that like nervous system regulation. And a lot of us come from that sympathetic fight or flight because whether it's just adaptive or we dissociate to get through the day or get through a situation because we aren't comfortable with who we are, don't know who we are, then we come from that state when it comes to our kids. And we're like, just stop doing that. You're driving me crazy, you know? And it's like, if I can't regulate my system, how can I show up for my six-year-old and teach him not only to be who he is, but also to regulate his system when he feels out of sorts? A lot of people are walking around with a lot of dysregulation and just hurt. And we don't know how to heal, but we don't allow other people the space to be themselves either. So that it's just this like crazy cycle of like hurt children walking through the world. And how do we fix it? We drink, we use drugs and alcohol to escape. We shop, we have sex. I mean, I'm guilty of the ice cream thing now, you know, like check out like Netflix. I mean, we all do it to some extent, but you know, using something outside of ourselves to regulate what's happening on the inside is kind of the band-aid that we use. And for all of us and a lot of people listening, it's the drugs and the alcohol. And alcohol's acceptable, which is the hard part, the challenging part.
Yeah, it's the advice everyone gives, right? Have a drink. It's so progressive. Do you want to talk about that for you? How like it started?
It's so funny. People are like, do you remember your first drink? I don't remember my first, but I do remember just the feeling of being like, oh, everything goes away. Mm-hmm. I also started smoking marijuana. I started doing drugs. I did like LSD in eighth grade. And it was just that feeling of like being home, right? It brought me that comfort. And I don't really recall it. Well, I don't know if it was that I didn't care anymore or that I felt so connected for the first time in my life. But whatever it was, it shut down those voices and that internal dialogue that said, I'm not enough. Because for me, that's where it came from. I wasn't enough. I wasn't good enough in swimming. I wasn't smart enough in school. I didn't have enough friends. I wasn't a good daughter. Like I wasn't all these things. I wasn't pretty enough, smart enough, funny enough. All in any room I walked into, I could find somebody who was better than me in any way. So therefore, I had to be less than. And so that's kind of how I walked through the world, you know, starting at a really young age. And for me, alcohol, then it was okay. And as we know, you know, putting those things in our body so young, it kind of stunts our emotional growth. And so when I got sober, I was a 14-year-old little girl, you know, that was acting out and that just wanted attention and love and help. And I think to your point, like all these things that are available to kids now, like whether it's, you know, vaping or alcohol, it's so easy. We used to steal my friend's dad's vodka because my parents didn't have alcohol in the home. And so we would take his vodka and then fill it with water.
Yeah.
And we told ourselves we were doing it to help him drink less.
I did that as well. And I remember my dad just going, Kate, what is this crap in here? We put water in here. A terrible American accent. He is American, but yeah. And I just thought, well, it's the same color. He went,
right.
That's because I was so young and inexperienced. I just shouldn't have been doing it. But yeah, I think there are so many similarities. And I love what you're saying about using external coping mechanisms. That's absolutely it. And it happens everywhere. And it's almost like a computer game where you're running around and going, let me try this, let me try this. What we need to do is just let our inner light shine out and say, let's just be. Is it true that a friend eventually said to you, if you don't stop, I'm going to tell your family that you're drinking? And that's what eventually made you kind of say, right, enough is enough.
It was a boyfriend. And, you know, I had tried to hide it from as many people as possible, but he was kind of front line and could see it, saw the blackouts. I remember him saying to me, he's like, every once in a while, you shines through. But for the most part, you're not you. And so, and then that part that wasn't me, the anger, the sadness, I mean, all of those things that happen when we drink started taking over that real me. And yeah, he said, he's like, you know what, this has gotten really bad and I've seen it get really bad. And if you don't get help, I'm going to go to your family and tell them how bad it was. And a lot of people have said to me, like, that seems like a really high bottom. And maybe, I mean, I didn't have this one, you know, I didn't wreck a car, I didn't end up in jail, you know, dot, dot, dot. My son says like, dot, dot, dot. I didn't do these things yet, right? But if I were still drinking, there's absolutely a guarantee that something like that would have happened. And so for me, it was the shame piece. I felt so ashamed into it. And I was like, okay, fine. You know, I had tried 12 steps before just to get people off my back. And I just didn't get it because I wasn't ready. I didn't really want to do it. I just wanted people to leave me and my drinking alone. Like, let us live our happy life together and just stop nagging me about, you know, dropping it. And he said that. He's like, you've gone, did these 12 steps before, you need to go to rehab. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to inpatient because that's for people with a real problem, you know? So I still was really ashamed of it. And I didn't want people to know that I was getting sober. So I went to an outpatient, which means after work, I would, you know, from 5:30 to 8:30, I would go to treatment and we would do like a group check-in and we would do feelings management, which, you know, for normal people, I say that in air quotes, you know, people that don't have addiction, they're like, what do you mean? Like, what do you need to manage your feelings? I'm like, I didn't realize that I was walking through with my shoulders, that my hands and fists and my jaw was clenched. And I was just walking through life waiting for something to erupt. You know, I just wanted to erupt on something. And so they taught us there, you know, like, hey, is your jaw tight? I'm like, oh, it is. Okay, why don't you exhale and bring your shoulders down? I'm like, oh, and it was literally like called feelings 101. But that's how I ultimately got sober. And I wasn't sure it was going to stick. I'm like, well, this doesn't work. You know, maybe I'll try inpatient. But for me, for someone that loves knowledge, I also needed a little bit of accountability. I needed to go in every day and have somebody say, did you drink last night? We also took Anabuse, which is a medication. If you drink, I'm probably butchering this description a bit, but makes you get really sick. So you don't feel the effects of the alcohol. You just get really sick from it. And so it's just a preventative tool that they used. And so I did that, and every day I would check in and they'd go around. They're like, how are you? Right. And I'm all about, because what I was taught, this is kind of my coping mechanism that I was taught when I was little. If you look good on the outside, it doesn't really matter on the inside, because if everybody else thinks I'm okay, then that's okay. And so that's how I operated for a really long time, including up to 15 years of recovery, being sober. And so I would go into the treatment center and I would say, I'm good. Everything is good. I'm not drinking now. And so I'm perfect now, because that's what, you know, I just wanted this idea of perfection. And I was like, I'm good. And then one day I was not good. And I went in and I'm like crying in the corner and I'm biting my lip and I have tears and they're like, are you okay? And I'm like, like, you know, trying to convince them that I'm okay. And I'm like, no, I'm not okay. I'm angry and I'm sad and I feel lonely and I don't understand because I'm not drinking now. So I should be perfect now. Like, I don't understand. And they're like, the drinking is just a symptom of the disease. Now comes the part when you,
the fun part,
the real work. But that's how I ended up there, because I was just ashamed, right? And that shame carried with me for, you know, a long time, even in recovery, which is why I decided to start speaking out and sharing my story a little bit, because I didn't want other women to feel that same shame.
A lot of people ask, when should I tell people? Do I tell people right away? How should I tell them? Should I be upfront and honest, or should I just tell them I'm doing dry January or just taking time off? So if you could explain a little bit how that went down with you and why you took the route you did.
Yeah. So when I got sober, there weren't a lot. I didn't know anybody. I didn't know anybody. Well, I did. That's not true. My a woman who had helped me, who actually stole the vodka with her dad, she was sober. And I only found this out on Do you guys remember MySpace?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could put, did you drink or do you smoke? And then you had like a song you could do. And so she had on there, I don't drink and I don't smoke. And I was at an active addiction. And I remember being, of course you do. I drank and smoke with you, all kinds of things, you know, and I reached out to her and she said, no, I got sober 5 years ago. And I'm like, what? And she said to me, and she said, your elevator's going down and you can choose to get off at any time. And that was the one thing that stuck with me because it gave me the choice. And something about that felt really empowering. So she was the only person I knew that was sober. Nobody in my family had gone to treatment. Nobody, I didn't know anybody who didn't drink. And that was by design, right? You know, surround yourself with people that are like me. And so I didn't share. Because also when I got sober, and that goes back to this knowledge seeker, I go to a bookstore and I'm like, I want to learn. I want to learn about addiction. I want to learn why. I want to learn. And there were three books. It was like the big book, Carolyn Knapp is Drinking a Love Story, and like what to expect your first year of sobriety or something. And that was it. There was like nothing. And so I got those books and I was trying to understand it. Went to meetings. I went to surrounding myself with other people, kind of got a new group of friends and all those things. But I told my family. But then outside of that group in 12 Steps, I started making other friends. And I didn't say anything because one, I didn't know how. And two, I was also a little ashamed. And three, at the time I was in a relationship where I was told that it was embarrassing. And so when that's something that's, it's perpetuating the feeling that you're already feeling inside and someone is kind of co-signing that, it's like, oh, okay, so maybe I shouldn't talk about this. And again, like mental health was just becoming a thing. I mean, meaning like it was more open to talk about. I think addiction and recovery and substance use disorder is only also now becoming something that people are talking about a little bit more. And so when that relationship ended, was when I was like, and it was after COVID, when all of a sudden you couldn't ignore the stats that were, I mean, stats are facts, right? So they were saying like 300% increase in women with young kids at home during COVID, 2.5 men to every one woman gets sober or seeks treatment. And those numbers seem really staggering to me. So I just had this moment of clarity when I was like, I don't have the luxury to stay silent anymore. When there are women who are dying and don't feel seen or heard or embarrassed or feel shame around this, like who am I to sit back after 15 years? Like I've got a little bit of time. I'm not worried about going out and taking a drink because now I've kind of crossed that threshold of I spent 15 years drinking. Now I've been 15 years sober. And it was literally, if I can help one woman with my story, I was a wine drinker. I was a blackout drinker, made bad decisions, but I didn't have the arrest. I didn't have the DUIs. And I feel like alcoholics were just, you know, it was Leaving Las Vegas or When a Man Loves a Woman. There are these really crazy stories of overdosing and wrecking a car and all of these. And I was like, but that's not my story. And so I wanted women with stories like mine, like you said in the beginning, lending all these voices to help people feel seen. You know, I think people want representation. They want to say like, okay, I can identify with her story or I can identify with that one. Okay, this gives me hope. And so I think the more people that are talking about this and their experience and their journey, the more powerful it is, the more people feel seen and can reach out for help. But it was literally that moment of, I don't have the luxury to stay silent anymore when there are so many people who are suffering and dying. I mean, all of these numbers are just, it's not getting better.
On your website, you've got a quote that says, shame hides in the darkness, but we recover and heal in the light. And I absolutely love that because for me, shame is a word that covers like an umbrella my whole adult life. And then even when you want to get sober, people saying it's embarrassing. You know, it's like you can't win as a woman, the shame surrounding me because I was meant to be this kind of fun party girl and I was meant to go out with the lads. And it was really cool that Kate was out with 10 guys and I could drink as much as them. But as soon as Kate started slurring her words or her eyes rolled or she fell over, oh my God, that's not what you're meant to do. And then it would be kind of like, it's again, that mask. It's acceptable as long as you maintain yourself and you're pretty and attractive and fun. But as soon as it slips, go away and deal with that yourself. The amount of shame I was carrying around was monumental. And that's what I've realized since I got sober, that the way you described your jaw and your shoulders, I was literally walking around like that for 20 years. Yeah. Hoping I wasn't going to see someone on the street who I'd never seen before, but who recognized me because I'd been out drinking with them the night before. Things like that, everything was scary. And I was in survival and defense mode constantly. And that's why I love that quote, because there's something so beautiful about it. And it's kind of saying, for once in your life, be exactly who you want to be. Get rid of that shame. And let's find the beauty of life and the beauty in you. And I think saying that to someone who's in the position that we three have all been in is enough to make someone break down because they're so relieved that the thought of unloading that burden of shame that we've carried for so long becomes so huge that when you do check into rehab or you do sign up to AA or you join a group or you make that decision, it's life-changing. And actually, it might be scary and people listening might think, well, it's terrifying. It's so much less terrifying than the option of carrying on. And as your friend said, carrying on going down in that elevator, mm-hmm. that's the scariest of all.
And it comes back to community, right? Because we can heal. Like where we heal is where we heal in community and people that support us, right? So and that, again, it all comes back to like finding our voice. Like who are we at our core? And then who do we want to be around? Who supports us versus like pushes us down? And I love that, Kate. It's like the bumper guards, right? Like for women, you stay in these lines. You continue to look right. You look pretty. You do those things. But if you make a decision and go home with the stranger or you do this, that is not ladylike and that is not cool. And you know what? Get back in line. Women are not supposed to be alcoholics. You can say you're depressed or have anxiety, but you know what? If you have a problem, then there's something wrong with you. Mm-hmm. It's like, of course, I'm an addict. There's nothing wrong with me. That's just who I am. You know, boy, it's like the opposite with men. If men say like, I'm having depression or anxiety, it's like, you should be tougher than that. It's okay if you're an alcoholic and you struggle. You know what I mean? I mean, it's this line of just let people be who they are, accept them for who they are, be willing to help them when they stumble. And for parents, like it is not a, you know, my mom, God bless her. She's like, is this my fault? Like, no. Because if you would have raised me differently, I would have found alcohol. You know, had I not found it at 14, I would have found it at 24 and my recovery would have gotten pushed off. It's in me. The thing is that, you know, it's a disease. It's not a decision. And so many people look at it as willing, you know, like, well, you're putting that cup to your mouth and you're doing it. And it's like, if you don't understand, you don't understand. And that's okay. There's just so much judgment about stuff we don't understand going around. And that's...
It's not just about being ourselves. It's about accepting other people for who they are. It's a two-way thing. Society needs to change. There needs to be more empathy and more understanding. It needs to soften. It needs to stop pushing people out there and saying, you've got to be a certain way. We've just got to be more accepting. We know what happens when you feel lost. You reach for something that's going to make you feel connected. But actually sitting in your front room in front of Netflix with three bottles of wine is not going to connect you with anything but the floor, is it really?
Right.
No. Yeah. And that's going back to the shame. Like there are still times I can find myself, and this is like the addict voice that happens. Like my sister makes fun of me because I'll go in the kitchen and I'll like eat ice cream in secret. And she's like, why don't you put it in a bowl and bring it out? I'm like, I don't know. It's this thing that's in me, but now I notice it more and it's ice cream. I'm not drinking vodka out of a freezer. Right. But part of that healing process is changing those behaviors and those thought patterns and start replacing them with new people, places, things that fill up our metaphorical cup, not our wine cup.
Yeah. I mean, so you've mentioned like distancing yourself from like the negative influences. Cause like you, like I was surrounded by drinkers. They either had to drink as much as me or more than me. Cause that kept me safe. It kept me comfy. It was like, oh, this is normal and I'm not as bad as her. So I'm good. You know, it was like my gate. It's really what kept it going for me, but that's all I had. And so there's this loneliness that comes in because you find out, at least I did very quickly when you quit drinking, that those people are no longer interested. They want to be supportive, but in order for a lot of them to be supportive, they have to kind of be a hypocrite about their own lifestyle, I think is what ends up happening, right? If they're supporting your sobriety, but then they're out drinking the same way you used to drink, it makes things really, really awkward. So how did that happen in your life? Like, did you have to have hard conversations with people? Did they just fade out?
So this is a great question too, because I think you start to act as a mirror, right? So for me, I black out every time I put alcohol in my body. And so they lost that person. So then the person underneath had to start looking at it. And the person underneath came to me and said, you know what? You're not drinking anymore and you're no fun. And that was like a dagger to my chest because I was all I wanted to be, Kate, like you said, was fun. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be the one people liked and the fun party girl and the funny one. That's not who I am. I mean, I'm funny and I'm whatever, but I'm better in smaller groups. Like I have my own sense of humor, but I'm not like my sister's funny and she's cool and she rides like Harleys. And I look at her, I'm like, he's amazing. That's not me. And that's okay. I think it all comes back to the, like who we are. But they started kind of fading away. And for me, because 12 steps was really, really huge. I mean, I went to meetings every single day and started surrounding myself with people that didn't drink. I had a friend, Claire, in early sobriety, and we did everything together our first year. We did vacations together. We did Thanksgiving together. She came to my family's home for, you know, Christmas. Like we did all of these things. She helped me move. And I had that kind of accountability partner almost. And, you know, when she was having a rough day, I was okay. When I was okay and she was having a rough day, it worked. And that was really great. And a sponsor and like mentorship, like those things were really important to me and like finding that community. And I think the beautiful thing about recovery and sobriety today is a sober curious movement. There are places online where you can, you know, like Sober Motivation and Suzanne Ware, the Sober Moms Cafe. Like there are so many places where you can find people. I mean, I'm still a huge fan of in-person community because I'm a hugger and I'm like a in-person person, but that's a good... But that's like a good way and a good path to start doing those things of finding other people. I also started going, I'd been doing yoga at that point for a couple of years and I started going to a yoga studio. So I started kind of meeting people that way. And that was really helpful. And that's the one thing, this is a beautiful thing about social media when you can meet other people who are like-minded and on the same journey as you. And that's like the one good thing about social media that I love. But for me, it just started, people just kind of started falling away and I started replacing them. But there's this great book called The Dark Night of Recovery. And it talks about that, like what people at 5 years, because in the beginning, it's really supportive and your family's really supportive and people are really supportive. But then it's like, oh, you're 5 years, you're good now. And it's like, but I'm still a human and I still need connection and I still need that community. And so it is hard. It's like these different transitions and iterations of, I call it healing, right? Like for me, sobriety was kind of that dark night of the soul that kind of kicked me into that being better for myself and finding out who I am. And every year it's like peeling off a piece of that onion layer, or that mask, Kate, like you say.
And what you're describing is how I often think of it. And it's kind of like, don't try and rush. You don't need to suddenly go out and surround yourself with 100 new friends and 20 new hobbies, because most of us only had drinking as a hobby, let's be honest. And when people said, what are your interests? I used to get so embarrassed and I used to make things up because I was like, I don't have any, if I'm being honest. I drink. But once you get rid of that, you value yourself so much more that it's almost like building yourself a new house. And actually, every brick you put into that house, you have to be really careful about it. And you have to just take your time. And it's actually quite enjoyable. You shouldn't rush into this, peeling the layers off or building the house or however you want to put it. You really need to give yourself some of the time that you gave yourself drinking. You know, we wasted 20 years drinking or more. We don't need to push sobriety and be perfect within a month. It's just not going to happen. Mm-mm. Actually, that kind of slow process of choosing new friends, new interests. Who am I? What am I actually good at? When I'm upset, why am I really upset? Because now I know that my mood isn't affected by alcohol. I can actually really start to understand who I am. And you've described like having a sense of purpose and sharing your journey. And that must have evolved because you've been sober for quite a long time now. So how has your purpose and your kind of approach to sobriety and the way that you share your story, how has that evolved? I would love to know where your future is going.
Thank you. Yeah. And I want to add something what you were saying too about the bricks, because I think that's such a powerful visual and I love that. I'm like a visual person. So that was really great. And there's also like each brick isn't perfect. It could be the wrong brick. It could be cracked. And you could be like, I actually don't like knitting. Okay, tried it, like next, you know, and that's okay. And for me, like my journey has not been linear either. At 5 years, I was diagnosed with severe depression for the first time. At 5 years sober, at 10 years, I had my son. At 15 years, I went through a divorce. I lost my dad. I launched a business and I moved. And I was like, I'm done. I'm going out. I am so done. And so the point in saying that is like, I'm going to go drink because I can't deal with this. This year has become so challenging. But for me, I'm so grateful that I had 15 years of other practices and other tools. Like I shared this story and it's funny. I went out and I bought, because when I got sober, I smoked cigarettes. And I did go out in October of 2022 and bought a pack of cigarettes. I didn't drink, right? And I quit 10 days later because I needed that external thing. Like I had so much grief around my dad that I was like, I don't know what to do. And I'm feeling so lost. And so the reason I share all that too is like, it's a journey. It is continues to be a journey. Next year could look, you know, different the year after that, 5 years from now. But what I realized at 15 years was when I started sharing my stories that I never wanted a woman to feel alone. And at first it was this really encompassing, like I want to help people who are struggling with addiction. And I started to niche it down because I realized that as women, we carry a lot, you know, and I use this example, like this metaphorical tray to go to this imagery. And I'm like, you want me to help you with work? Okay. You want me to help you? Okay. I've got the kids. I'll pick them up after school. Yep. I'll do the permission slip. Yep. I'll make dinner. Yep. I got this. Just keep putting it on my tray. Okay. I got it. And we put ourselves last. And so what I really wanted to do was help women find their voice and live in their purpose. Because for me, that's where I really struggled. And I learned breath work and yoga and meditation and mindfulness and got holistic coaching training and did all these things. And so as I move forward, you know, sobriety is where I started, but I've really evolved along the way of becoming You know, it's spirituality, nervous system regulation, and just all these different ways to be the person I want to be. Like, I don't want to judge. I don't want to walk through life with anger. I do want to have love for everyone and empathy, even the people who I don't always want to give it to, you know, because I am human and I get angry and I get frustrated and all those things. And so that's kind of where it is. So my sobriety and my recovery helps me be a better person first and foremost for me. So I can, you know, give it to my child. I can give it to my partner. I can show up for my family. And so last year I launched a coaching platform for women. It's called The Right Room. And what I realized was that for so long, it wasn't that my voice was wrong and I was wrong. I was just in the wrong room. And so in order to find the right room, again, imagery, I use this idea of like, I'm in the wrong room, opening the door. And then you just see this hallway, a huge hallway of doors. And it's like, I don't know which one to go into. Kate, what you were saying, like the bricks, like this one might not work. So I walk in a door and I open it and I'm like, this doesn't feel like the right room. Okay, next one, and trying different things. But it all comes back to like figuring out who we are. And I want to help women and hold space for women to find that voice. Because once we find our own voice and we can kind of ground ourselves into who we are, we can find our purpose, and then we can live a life that feels true and authentic to us. And so from that, I created a coaching platform, and I have one-on-one coaching with women. We have cohorts of women, smaller group coaching. Right now, it's just for, I have one for sober women, women in recovery that identify as addicts, and then one is sober curious. And it's ways to create that community and heal in spiritual, mental, emotional, and physical ways, that holistic practice. That's helped me. And so that's where I am now. In a perfect sky in the pie world, I would love to help change policies around recovery, specifically in women, allowing them time to go to treatment. I think it's easier for men right now to say, you take the responsibility at home. I'm going to, you know, like my coworkers, you have this, I'm going to go do it for 30 days, where I think it's a little bit more challenging for women. So I'd love to see that available to more women.
The place that you've just described, the rooms, they just sound wonderful, don't they, Steph?
Yeah.
Really caring and empathetic, and other people who can understand. And I think that's what, at the end of the day, we all need. We just want someone who cares and someone who says, you can do this. And we want to be able to see someone else who has done it and who is smiling and who we think, I like that person. You know, this is possible. I can find who I am. And then suddenly life opens up. And it's gone from gray to colorful.
So my partner says, like, this is the only you I know. And I just want to be clear for anybody listening. This was not me a year ago. This was not me 5 years ago. It's like whittling away and kind of, you know, figuring out, what do I stand for? What do I want to say? What do I believe? And then really owning that. I was talking to a friend the other day that's not in recovery, that doesn't have a problem. They're not, you know, it's a couple. And they're like, we just don't understand addiction. What can you tell us? And I said, this is the easiest way to understand addiction. It is hanging out with a best friend who's trying to kill you. And you can't let them go because you love them. It's your best friend. But they're trying to kill you. It's like, they're like, that's crazy. I'm like, yeah. Yeah.
Thanks for tuning in. We're just two women from opposite sides of the pond striving to shed light on the negative impacts of alcohol. Quick heads up, we're not licensed therapists or doctors. If alcohol is seriously affecting your mental or physical health, seek professional help.
And don't forget to hit that follow button to catch all of our future episodes. If you think our podcast could make a difference to someone you know, share the love. And hey, leaving a 5-star review will really help the Sober Effect reach more fantastic people like you. So thank you.